Welcome to the Meal Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Lindsay S. Nixon. This is the seventh episode in the co-pilot series where we can chat about making the plant-based lifestyle more doable, especially while facing a lot of the challenges and roadblocks we all face. My co-pilot today, I'm very excited, is a doctor right outside of one of my favorite cities, which is Las Vegas, and we're going to talk about that. But I'm really excited to have him on today and just kind of get that doctor's perspective. And he's also been working to make his family practice a plant-based practice. So if you are a medical professional wanting to do the same, he's going to have some tips for you. But I'd like to give a big hand. Please help me in welcoming Dr. Allen to the podcast today. And before I forget, if you want to learn more about him, he also sees patients not only in Southern Nevada, but anywhere in the world, you can consult with him. Visit his website, drallenwellness.com, and you spell it doctor, the full spelling of doctor, but I'll mention that again. So anyway, hi, doctor, how are you?
Well, hello, Lindsay. I'm doing great, and it's really great to be here today and excited to talk with you and get some information out there.
Yes, I'm so glad. And as I mentioned, one of the things why I'm so happy to have you is because you're actually sort of in the trenches dealing with patients and giving, you know, the plant-based diet as sort of a prescription. And we just don't kind of get that perspective a lot from others. So I'm really excited to pick your brain on that. So we have a lot of questions for you today. Everyone wrote in with all these great questions. But
wonderful.
Yeah. But first, why don't you tell us how you found your way to a plant-based diet? Like, how did this all happen for you? And how did you end up wanting to bring it to your practice?
All right. Well, it's interesting. There are a lot of similarities between our stories, actually.
Yeah?
As a child, I grew up vegetarian as well. My parents were not both vegetarian. My mother was vegetarian. And so, you know, how the mom eats is how the kids are going to eat. And I was vegetarian and kind of grew up basically thinking meat was icky and never wanted to have anything to do with it. And actually, to this day, I've never eaten meat in my life.
Oh, wow.
But as you know, being a vegetarian isn't always that much of a protection for you. And, you know, my dad was not vegetarian and kind of watched his health decline through his life. He ended up passing from dementia, you know, obesity and diabetes and all the problems that people develop over a standard American diet. And that really didn't have much of an effect on me. I still kind of thought diet was just a bunch of woo-woo. Even though I was a vegetarian, I should have been interested in it. I was really more of just a cultural vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
The thought of eating meat disgusted me, so I really... Which is a nice thing to have, actually, now that I know a little bit more about nutrition.
It's right.
It's nice to have a category of foods that are really bad for you that you consider something you would never eat.
Right.
So, you know, the story goes, as so many people will tell you, you know, everything changed when they had a child. So my son was born, and I had to get an insurance physical. And, here I am thinking, I'm this doctor, you know, I know everything there is to know about medicine, you know, in my own life, I think that. And I get this insurance physical and it comes back that I had a fatty liver.
Oh, wow.
Well, I was not happy about that. A little distressed, and I started, you know, started researching into it, and, you know, I was pretty unhappy about it. And my wife said, okay, well, we're gonna watch this Forks Over Knives video that was available for us to watch. And so I watched it and I got to the end of it. And, you know, you're a vegetarian, kind of makes you feel good about having been a vegetarian all your life to watch it.
Right.
But as a doctor, I'm thinking, no, this is all quackery. It can't actually be true. It can't make that much of a difference to your health, what you eat. And, you know, in medical practice, we sort of are familiar generally with the outlines of some of the studies that have been done. Doctors knew about Dr. Dean Ornish's study, reversing heart disease, and it's sort of at the periphery of our awareness is this idea that there's this guy out in Cleveland who puts people on bean sprouts and reverses their heart disease.
Right.
It's not part of the culture of medicine. And again, that's sort of like Upton Sinclair's famous statement that it's very hard to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it.
Oh, that's a good point.
So I basically took it upon myself that I was going to prove Forks Over Knives wrong, get into the weeds of the science and burrow down and find out where these people had it so desperately wrong. And every rock I kept turning over kept you know, saying, no, they're right. You know, they're right. I really could not find anything that really argued with my knowledge of medicine. And essentially what you have to do if you decide as a doctor that, you know, the message inside a plant-based diet is incorrect, is you have to abandon the idea that cholesterol is a risk factor for disease, which, you know, cholesterol is not just a risk factor for heart disease. It's a risk factor for kidney disease. It's a risk factor for diabetes. It's a risk factor for macular degeneration. You know, it's a risk factor for all sorts of diseases. And people with cholesterol problems, you know, severe ones, will have heart attacks and strokes in their 20s and 30s. So the idea that cholesterol is somehow good for you or you should try to get high, it just makes absolutely no sense at all of both my, you know, personal experience and my reading of science. So after about 6 months of really investigating this, I kind of determined, hey, you know, these people who are pushing this plant-based diet are exactly right. And then I sort of, you know, again, a lot of similarities in our story. I sort of read John McDougall, and I would say, you know, sort of like, what's the statement? The scales were lifted from my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here he is, this, you know, board certified internist who had this long history of, you know, practicing this way, and he has an answer down the line for all the objections that I might have come up with. So that really, you know, cinched it for me. And my son has been, you know, eating this way since he was born. Well, he wasn't vegan when he was breastfeeding. That was mammalian milk.
I still count that as vegan. I count breast milk as vegan, sure, yeah.
So we'll say he's been vegan since birth then. But, you know, we've been seeing remarkable results. My fatty liver reversed within 6 months.
Oh, wow.
I lost about 45 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
My wife had gained quite a bit of weight with her pregnancy, and she is now down below the weight when I met her, which she was, you know, really, really slender when I met her, to the point where her big problem right now is being able to eat enough to keep the weight on.
Oh, my, wow. I know a lot of people wish they had that problem.
Getting enough calories in for the day. So I don't have that problem yet myself either.
Yeah, I have a very big appetite, so that's not me. My husband's a little bit more peckish, but I don't know if you know this about Dr. Campbell, who's in Forks Over Knives, and he did the China study, but he is a lot like you in the sense that he set out because he believed that milk was perfect and animal protein was perfect, and animal protein was just so amazing that he started his whole career trying to figure out how to, you know, make it better or get it in people, get it more. Cause he just, you know, he grew up on a dairy farm. And so he just like loved animal protein, and he got a big surprise with his own research. And he was just like, what? No, this can't be. And, but he was like you, it just, everything kept coming back, and eventually he kind of accepted it. And he's sort of the father of the whole movement with his research. But I always found that so interesting that this man who grew up on a dairy farm, and believed animal protein was so great, was the person to realize it wasn't.
Well, yeah, my connection with that is I was actually born in the Philippines, which is where he was doing
everything. Yeah.
And the other connection I would have is I probably ate as much cheese as the dairy farm put out. I was a vegetarian. You know, when you go to a restaurant and you're a vegetarian, what do they give you? They give you
cheese.
Cheese and cream.
So. Yeah, it's like liquid meat. I think that's what Rip Esselstyn calls it, liquid meat. Or maybe that's his dad.
I know Dr. McDougall says that as well.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that, because when I was a child and I was a vegetarian, my dad knew one other vegetarian. And it was like a secretary or a woman he worked with. And she was, you know, very overweight and had lots of health problems. And she basically ate cheese all day, every meal. And so my parents were always really scared of letting me be vegetarian because they didn't want me to end up with like all her health problems. But it's like you said, you can do vegetarian wrong. Like you think you're doing it right, but a lot of vegetarians I've met, they're so heavy on the cheese and the egg. And so they're getting like huge amounts of saturated fats and cholesterols, you know, maybe even more so than someone who only eats steamed chicken.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And honestly, and I think I agree here with Dr. McDougall as well, and I think Dr. Campbell's made comments similar to this, but I'm not sure. If I can only get a patient to ditch one thing, I would get them to ditch dairy.
Yeah, me too.
By far you know, the most ubiquitous and the worst component of a diet. And, you know, I've had, you know, cases where the patient's like, I can't do this, I can't do that. I said, well, just ditch cheese and milk and yogurt and all that. Just get rid of dairy and see what you do. And they get results. And that's the other beauty of this approach is, you know, it's not one size fits all. The more you put into it, the more you get out of it, you know. But if somebody wants to do a little bit, they'll go a little bit of the way.
That's what I say too. And people are like, what's the one thing? What one thing? Just narrow it down. And I, like you, I always, always say dairy. And I, you know, I've had, you know, thousands of clients through the meal plans now, and it's unbelievable how much just singularly taking out that dairy makes a difference. And one thing I've also noticed is when people stop, you know, eating the dairy, not only do they lose weight and feel better, and a lot of medical, like eczema, I've noticed goes away on everybody who gives up dairy. Like, it's almost immediate. It's amazing. IBS is another one. But then they also just naturally reduce their meat consumption because, like, a taco suddenly isn't exciting without the cheese. Like, or a pizza is, you know, they don't want a pepperoni pizza anymore. It's so, even though you're saying that one thing, I find it actually has big tentacles that reach quite far.
And that's exactly right. And the other thing is it makes someone conscious of what they're eating.
Absolutely.
They just have to think about what they eat, which, you know, we know from many studies, just having someone pay mindful attention to what they choose to consume has major effects on, you know, caloric density, how much they actually end up eating per serving, with no reduction in their pleasure of their life. That's the thing that, you know, you see over and over again that people are worried about making this change. Is, you know, I lose all this wonderful food that I enjoy so much. And, you know, I think that fear is what sort of holds people back. Plus, they, you know, they lack the social proof. They don't have enough friends who've done it. They don't know enough people who've done it. So it's really a terra incognito for them, or incognita, excuse me. They're troubled by that.
Yeah, that's a good point about the social proof, because there are so many people who feel totally alone. They don't know anybody else. And even sometimes they, you know, even their own doctors aren't supportive. And that was one thing I wanted to ask you about is I hear this all the time with the meal plan users that, you know, my doctor's not supportive, or my doctor found out my kids are plant-based and is like threatening to, you know, turn me over to social services. Like, they really, I mean, it's shocking how many times I've heard, you know, anything from naturopaths to medical MDs to their cardiac doctor, you name it, has just been like, no, you can't do this. And I mean, do you have advice for them? Like, maybe what they could say to ease the tension, or should they just not even mention it at all?
Well, the number one advice I would use right now would be to try to find a plant-based doctor, which there's just a growing number of.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I read a news article, seems like every other day now. There was one a week ago about a doctor in New Jersey who had made the change, and another one today about a doctor in Texas. So I think this is becoming something where, again, the evidence ends up playing out, and doctors want their patients to get better more than anything else.
Right.
And so once a doctor starts using this approach, it becomes really, really addictive, because you don't really like watching it just get worse, slightly slower on pills.
Right.
And so the first, if at all possible, is to find a doctor. But if that's not a possibility, or there's an insurance reason why you have to see a certain person at a certain place or whatever, then I think the best approach is to say, you know, look, I've investigated this myself, and, you know, I've spent some hours on it, and I'm going to try it for a while, see what happens. And if it's working well for me, I'm going to continue to do it. If I'm having, you know, problems, then, you know, I will do some more research and find out if there's an issue. You know, from my point of view as a plant-based doctor, I can't think of any non-fixable issue in somebody eating a plant-based lifestyle. There's simply always a way to fix it, even in somebody who, you know, might be doing something I wouldn't recommend for everybody else. There's still always, you know, a plant-based alternative for anything that somebody might end up needing. But, you know, I have this problem here in Vegas where I'll have patients. I had a patient who had liver failure, and we put him on an extremely protein-restricted diet initially to try to get some fluid off him. He lost about 60 pounds of water weight over a couple of months.
Woo!
Just with diet change, no diuretic, which, you know, when a physician hears that a patient with liver failure was, you know, keeping all their fluid off with just diet, they think I'm not telling the truth, because that's so unheard of. You know, when I was a resident, we would have to just drain liters and liters of fluid out of people's abdomens over and over who were in liver failure. So, but he'd then go see specialists who would say, no, you should be eating lots of red meat and getting your protein status up, which, you know, biologically makes no sense because ammonia is a problem in liver failure. The only source of ammonia that people eat, unless they drink household cleaning products, is going to be protein. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this was really difficult. You know, I actually researched into it and you know, talked to him all about it and everything. And he stuck with it, which is great. But it can be very psychologically difficult for someone who's, you know, made a big commitment and made a big change in their life and they're doing well to hear those negative reviews from what are supposed to be experts. And so that's the other job, is to teach other doctors and convince other doctors about the way this is. And the good news is, again, a lot of doctors here in Las Vegas are starting to see the light, and at least not being a roadblock in the way if someone wants to do it, and not saying that it won't work.
I mentioned in the introduction that I love Las Vegas, and I do. I love it. And one thing I have noticed about Las Vegas is how plant-based friendly it is. Like, I've traveled all over the world, all over the United States, and I went to Vegas, and I really was expecting to be hungry. I mean, honestly, I was really thinking we're going to have to take a cab to Whole Foods all the time. I'm going to be so hungry. And I got there and I wanted to like slap myself for thinking that, because I, even on the strip, like in the middle of this tourist bubble, I was finding not just vegan options, but truly healthy plant-based options. And I ended up getting together with like a vegan group in Vegas for a meetup, and they were telling me about hundreds of more things that I didn't even know about. And I was just blown away. I don't know why I thought it was going to be so difficult. Maybe because I think it's a vacation destination for adults, so it's going to be like steakhouses everywhere. And there certainly were. But the funny thing is I had to go to a steakhouse because I was there for like a wedding bachelor kind of situation, and that's where the guys wanted to go. And I had the best plant-based meal.
Yep. No, there's actually a gentleman named Paul Graham who's written a book called Eating Vegan in Vegas. If it can happen here, it can happen anywhere. And his book's been an invaluable resource for my family and myself. And that's going to show anybody who lives in Southern Nevada what to do, or anybody who's traveling here who wants to be able to go places. And I like how you kind of double-tiered that, not just vegan, but actually healthy.
Yeah.
That's an important distinction to make. Unfortunately, you know, I'll see a lot of vegans because they do want a plant-based doctor, but they may not necessarily be getting it right. And so I'll have people come in with total cholesterol to 260 or 270, worse than them. They made the switch because they make little errors like, you know, cooking everything in coke. So I think Vegas is a wonderful place to eat plant-based. And if you know what you're doing, you can really get fantastic food at just about any place. And the reason is there's a lot of high-end, educated people who are making this change. And these restaurants know, you know, how to make money. And
right.
So if you want to turn those customers away, then they're going to be really, really unhappy. So we've been pretty comfortable just stepping into just about any of the higher-end places on the Strip, and they'll work with you. You know, some of the mid-range or the chain places, they able to.
Yeah, that's definitely been my experience. I mean, I loved it so much, and I love going to the shows and things like that too, but we go it's almost like our place that we go to vacation now, because it's so easy. And that's been the way, like, we'll meet our friends, you know, they'll fly in from wherever in the US, and it's like our meeting spot, and they'll be like, oh, where can you go? And I'm like, anywhere. You pick the place, and I'm sure they'll cater to me. And after maybe 8 or 9 different times now, there's never been a problem. Like you said, any of these middle or higher end restaurants, which is what we're going to because we're on vacation, we want to be fancy. And they do amazing, amazing things. But one thing you said that reminded me of a question one of our members asked is it possible for cholesterol or triglycerides to go up or not go down on a vegan diet? And I've seen that happen with some clients, but maybe you could talk a little bit about why that happens, why, you know, being vegan is not necessarily enough.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I get to that, and I will answer that, I did want to make one specific restaurant recommendation.
Oh, please.
Sanavino is run by Vincenzo Granata, who's the manager there, and he has been plant-based for quite a few years. He has an oil-free plant-based menu that's available for anybody there, and then they have the two tiers. They have a vegan menu well, they have three really, because they have their animal-based menu and then the vegan menu, and then they have an oil-free plant-based menu available. So anybody who wants to get really high and delicious dining can certainly go to Panavita.
And where is this located? Like in
Sunset and the Strip.
Sunset and the Strip. And it's called what again?
Panavino.
Panavino.
P-A-N-E-V-I-N-O. And it's a phenomenal restaurant. I would recommend it to anybody who likes food.
I haven't been there yet, but now you've definitely got me interested in going.
Yeah, when you go, just ask for Vincenzo and he will, you know, treat you correctly. They're so hospitable.
And Stephen Nguyen, who did a lot of the hotels there, including the one in the Encore, he's actually a vegan too, right?
That's correct. So anywhere at the Wynn or anywhere at the Encore will have a vegan menu that you can usually tweak.
Yeah, I stayed there and they did oil-free plant-based fare for me for every single meal. Didn't blink an eye. I was very impressed. So, and it was nice to just see the options, even if I didn't want to fuss, but they were really accommodating too. Oh, and also there is a plant-based doctor's list on happyherbivore.com and we list them worldwide. So if you need to find a doctor, and of course our doctor on this podcast is on there too, but let's get back to the triglycerides and LDL and the vegan diet and how it can still make them go high.
Sure. So the thing that causes elevated cholesterol and elevated triglycerides in any of the lipid profile abnormalities is the totality of the diet and how much the diet is composed of saturated fat and how much is composed of simple free sugars. Now, I hope that, you know, nobody thinks that adding a teaspoon or tablespoon of sugar to a recipe to make it taste better or anything like that is some horrible thing. And you should enjoy your food and it should taste good. But, you know, eating foods that are primarily composed of sugar is a problem. And especially if it's, you know, simple table sugar or brown sugar, something like that, where that's a, you know, big portion of calories of the dish. And so when you do that, you eat a lot of fructose, and fructose seems to drive both LDL cholesterol and triglycerides. And, you know, that's one of the beauties of your recipes is they always avoid the high fructose corn syrup and the high fructose dishes. And, you know, we just love all of your desserts. They're so fantastic.
Aw, thanks.
We've been cooking from Happy Herbivore Light and Lean and Happy Herbivore Abroad now for over 8 months. And just every dish is just fantastic.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it.
But if somebody is not using your recipes, they may, you know, they might be an Oreos and Diet Coke vegan, and Oreos and Diet Coke vegan will get a lot of saturated fat and they'll get a lot of that fructose. Mm-hmm. And so those tend to drive triglycerides up in the case of the fructose, but also LDL cholesterol. And saturated fat is going to be always the primary driver of cholesterol in anybody's diet. And so, unfortunately, all oils, regardless of the oil, have some degree of saturated fat in them. You know, olive oil, I think, is something between 15 and 25% calories from saturated fat.
Oh, wow. That's a lot. I mean, yeah. I don't use it, so I never see the nutrition label, but that's crazy.
Well, no, the nutritional label doesn't say anything. The nutrition label calls it a monounsaturated fat, and that's what you think.
Oh, that's those sneaky food guidelines.
When we break down the actual chemicals in the various fats, they're all a mix of fat. And unfortunately, the very worst ones are plant fats. They're palm oil and coconut oil. Those have more saturated fat on a per calorie basis than lard or butter.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah. So unfortunately, you know, the vegan label has now become a very, very popular label commercially. You know, people love to, you know, put V and get the vegan label thing. And it's perceived to be a health benefit to be on. But often these are highly processed foods that are made with coconut oil and actually are worse than the animal fat, which in no way, you know, is to say the animal fats are good.
Right.
So when you're, you know, when you're worse than the guy who got kicked out of school, you're in pretty bad shape. So some vegans make the switch. They don't really understand, you know, the deeper concepts of nutrition, and it's wonderful that, you know, only palm trees and coconut trees are getting hurt rather than animals, and I think that's great. But their health is also not really responding in the way that a lot of people do get when they make a change. And so I think that's the thing that people often are quite clear on. And it's difficult to get people's minds around the idea that oil is not so good for them.
Oh, and there's so much marketing around it now. And I mean, I keep seeing marketing for coconut oil and how it's just like miracle food. And it makes me want to bang my head against the wall. I'm like, stop it. No, it's not. It's not going to make you skinny. That's what it'll be like. Oh, you need to lose weight? Use coconut oil. Oh, you're tired? Eat coconut oil. Drink coconut oil. And it's just like, what? No.
Well, it's interesting. The coconut oil and palm oil became major players after trans fats were outlawed. And the reason that trans fats were outlawed was because they were solid at room temperature and they were killing people. And you can, you know, figure out from that if coconut oil and palm oil are good replacements for trans fats, they are also solid at room temperature, which means they are also killing people.
Right.
You know, so, and the processed food industry wants solid fats at room temperature because that increases shelf life and stability and makes their products, you know, even commercially viable. If they had to put in a different fat mix, the products would go rancid on the shelf.
That's interesting. Yeah, I never realized that was the issue, is because it would go rancid if it wasn't a solid at room temperature. But that's true, because I've seen coconut oil in the store and it is kind of a solid. It's not like liquidy as like, say, an olive oil.
Yeah, well, in Vegas in the summer, your coconut oil gets nice and liquid.
Yeah, I was just going to say, but maybe in Vegas, it gets really warm. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. It is funny how much the food industry and marketing really seems to confuse people. And I really liked how you said that a lot of vegans will come into it and not intentionally do it wrong, but they just don't have the foundation. Because I see that all the time with people who come to me to kind of get like a meal plan and guidance. And I see that they've been vegan for a long time, but their health is failing and they're not feeling great. And they're like, but everyone says that I should lose weight and my skin will clear and my, you know, my cholesterol will improve and all these things. And none of it's happened and I feel worse. And it's because they were, like you said, they were eating all of these convenience foods and processed foods, you know, coconut bliss ice cream, day of cheese, you know, all these things that have all kinds of crazy preservatives and chemicals and all these oils in them. And it's like, well, I'm not really surprised that because you were eating French fries, Oreos, and Coca-Cola that you're not thriving. You know, that's not exactly what I kind of envision when I think of a plant-based diet.
Exactly. And you know, it's unfortunate, but if you're trading lard and butter out for coconut and palm oil, you're actually a bad trade for your health in some ways.
And some of the popular vegan, like the vegan butter substitutes, I think all they are is palm oil.
Right, exactly.
So, my goodness.
It's just a really bad mix.
So one thing, of course, and I'm sure when you suggest a plant-based diet to your clients, they ask you this too, is, oh my gosh, you know, where am I going to get my protein? Where am I going to get my calcium? And then, of course, the big one is B12. And a lot of people ask that. That was the question they sent in. How much B12 do I need to get? What supplement should I take? Should I do a spray or drops or chew things? What do I do? I can't go outside because, you know, I live in LA, you live in Vegas, we're around sunshine all the time. But, you know, maybe you could sort of give some suggestions or tell us what maybe is better if you need to take a supplement. And should you take a supplement? How do you know if you need to take a supplement?
So absolutely. I think B12 should be a much bigger issue for everybody than it is. You know, the nice thing is that, you know, I think most of the vegans that I'm running into and people who are trying to eat plant-based diets that are healthier are very aware of B12 and they think about it. And so I almost never find anybody who's B12 deficient in that group because they do a good enough job at getting their B12. But there's an epidemic of B12 deficiency in this country. And it's primarily being driven by, you know, the prevalence of acid reflux, which is caused by the, you know, high animal food diet the Americans eat. They take so many animal foods in that they have to take Zantac or Pepcid or Tums or something that always suppresses their stomach acid, and then they get B12 deficient because they can't absorb their B12. But, you know, somebody who's following a strict plant-based diet and is not eating any animal products of any sort and doesn't drink, you know, stream water that's unprocessed, which I think is probably the original source of B12 in the human diet, was that, you know, animals would go poo-poo in the stream and then people would drink their stream water and then that would have the B12 from their feces, which is the primary source of B12. So if you're getting your B12 from animal foods, you now know what part of the animal.
Right. Or if, you know, the manure on the plants or some other lovely We did not always live in such a germ-free, clean, sterile place.
Exactly, but I'm perfectly happy with the, you know, the no feces diet. That's that I am more than willing to give up. I don't have anybody who comes to me telling me they can't give it up. So what I recommend is that anybody who's really trying to get healthy and is, you know, cutting most animal products out of their diet should get a B12 supplement at least once a week. And it should be at least 2,500 micrograms. And it should be dissolved under the tongue. And the reason I make that recommendation is because if they do it once a week and it dissolves under their tongue, they'll absorb almost all of it. Your body recycles this stuff like crazy. It's not really going to run out on that dose under any circumstances. And if you can remember to take it once a week and you do well with that, then no problem. If you're not the kind of person who can remember to do something once a week because you get out of your habit,
right,
then, you know, 500 or 1,000 microgram tablets that you put under your tongue every day, perfectly reasonable. You're never going to, you know, we don't worry about people ODing on B12. So don't worry about getting too much. But, you know, when you talk about where do you get your protein, where do you get your calcium, you know, the same place as a cow. Cows are herbivores. Largely in the real world, when they are out on pastures, they're perfectly happy. But, you know, the modern cow is actually the world's largest sea predator because they feed so much fish meal to cattle in the United States. But a normal cow will get all of its nutrients from plants. And a normal gorilla gets all its nutrients from plants. And a normal elephant gets all its nutrients from plants.
Right.
And, you know, when I see your little logo, I think to myself, you know, I don't imagine any elephant has ever had protein deficiency or calcium deficiency, and they certainly have plenty of both.
Yeah.
So the appropriate human diet, when someone is getting adequate calories, has never been shown to cause clinical calcium deficiency or clinical protein deficiency. It just doesn't happen. But people have this idea that they need calcium and protein because they have a dairy industry telling them they need calcium all the time, and they have a meat industry that's telling them they need protein all the time. And so they have this idea. It's like people who live on the West Coast, you know that you have to have a car to survive. If you don't have a car, you're just going to die.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a car. But if you live in Manhattan, you know, one of the East Coast cities where a car is quite optional, you know, people look at you kind of funny when you're worried about not having a car. It's just a lifestyle that we've become accustomed to here in America, that you've just got to think about calcium and protein all the time. But, you know, a simple look at other animals should, you know, end that question. You know, the bigger question should be, where do Americans get the fiber from?
Yes, absolutely. That's my comeback usually, is where do you get your fiber from? And people are like, what? Like, they can't answer. They can't answer you when you ask them where they get their fiber. And that's a good point. I always like to point that out too, is it's like, oh, you people want to eat meat because they want to be as strong as the ox, not taking a minute to realize that the ox eats grass.
Exactly. The largest, strongest animals on earth are almost entirely herbivorous, with the exception of the blue whale, which eats, you know, krill, which I suppose people could eat krill. Really wanted to look like a blue whale.
There's, yeah,
tiny microscopic crustaceans. Not really, probably an appetizing diet for most people.
Yeah, I think that's probably with the feces, in which most people are really happy to give that up.
Exactly.
And what about vitamin D if you don't live in Las Vegas or Los Angeles like we do?
Well, you know, curiously enough, Lizzie, in my population here in Las Vegas, even though you would think we get loads of sun, I see vitamin deficiencies of D all the time. And I think, again, it's just people's workplace is usually indoors, and when you work indoors, you're just not getting that sunlight, even if
that's true,
glaring down. So, you know, the very best and most ideal place to get vitamin D from is always going to be this. And then there's, you know, I think everybody should probably get tested and see where they're at. My darker skin patients will frequently be pretty profoundly vitamin D deficient and be symptomatic and have some problems from that. And that's a major risk factor down the line for, you know, bone health and maybe even some other illnesses, although we're not completely sure. There's certainly a correlation between low vitamin D levels and multiple sclerosis, but that's not an established link. But What I recommend to people is, if at all possible, get it from the sun. But if you can't get it from the sun and you've been trying and your D level just doesn't come up on the blood test, then take a supplement. But if you're going to take a supplement, you also need to get a blood level done after you've been on the supplement to make sure that it's coming up and it's appropriate. Unfortunately, you know, many vitamin manufacturers are not the world's most scrupulous people. So there have been, you know, lots of studies looking at, you know, what it says on the bottle versus what's actually in the capsule. And there's a big mismatch sometimes, and upwards of sometimes 60% of the products. So if you're going to buy an over-the-counter vitamin D supplement, make sure that it actually raises your vitamin D level in the blood. I'll use a prescription D2, 50,000 unit, once a week vitamin D supplement that I will write as a prescription. For two reasons. First, because it's a prescription, it has to meet FDA requirements. It means you actually do require some degree of testing. And secondly, D2 is always from plant sources, so you never really have to worry about it being sourced from animals. D3 can occasionally be animal sourced. Most of the D3 that's on the market now does come from fungus.
Something else that's really appetizing.
Oh, mushrooms are fungus.
I know, I love mushrooms, but it's so funny when we call them fungus. You're like, oh no.
Right. Well, people think of foot.
Yeah.
But I do recommend for quite a few patients who just can't get enough sunlight that they take a D supplement. And there's some controversy about that as well. I know Dr. McDougall is really against D supplements. But I think on balance, you know, if we could all live like we're supposed to, which is, you know, spending large amounts of time out of doors and letting the sun shine on us, absolutely that would be the way to get your vitamin D. But especially if you're darker skinned and you have an indoor job, it's pretty difficult to ask your boss for, you know, 2 hours to go lay in the sun between 10 and 2
right, yeah.
in the months of March and October to get adequate vitamin D. And so unless you're doing that, or you're taking a 2-week midsummer vacation somewhere where the sun shines all day and you stay out in it all day, it's going to be tough to get enough vitamin D for some people.
And one thing too, so my sister's been anemic forever. She tried to be, you know, eating meat all the time. And when she went plant-based, her anemia actually improved a lot. But for whatever reason, she can't seem to get as much iron as she needs. So she's had to go on a supplement. But one thing that I found really fascinating with my sister is her doctor kept saying that even though there were so many milligrams or whatever in a supplement, that doesn't mean that you're going to automatically get all of that. And that's also true for the food. Maybe you could talk about bioavailability and how not to get too obsessed with the numbers, because, you know, your body's kind of in flux.
Yeah, the body is generally going to be able to solve problems unless there's some dysfunction somewhere, which may be the case with your sister. I'm not, you know, we don't know enough there. But when you take an iron supplement, you know, people will always tell me, well, exactly how much iron should I take? And I pretty much say anything that you're going to buy that actually contains iron, you will absorb the maximum amount of iron that you can absorb from that, regardless of how much or how little is in there. Because you really do have a limited ability to absorb non-heme iron. The heme iron that people get from, you know, meats and dairy products is absorbed 100%, but that can lead to major problems there as well. And that heme iron doesn't always get turned into available iron to make hemoglobin for the person themselves, but is a major risk factor for other diseases, for, you know, fatty liver problems, and for certain cancers, which iron consumption is a risk factor for, while non-heme iron consumption is not a risk factor for.
And is this also true for things like vitamin C, that just because the pill says it has X amount that you might not get that?
Everybody should be extremely skeptical of any supplement that's sold under the, you know, food additive or as a nutraceutical type thing. Because when these products are tested, they have about a 1/3 likelihood of having what's on the label. And that's really not the kind of risk you want to take.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
And, you know, especially, you know, people can, I guess, take whatever risk they want with themselves, but there's no regulation of this market at all. The supplements are deemed safe until proven unsafe. So the only way that a bad supplement will come off the market is if it's actually harming people, But I think it's harmful to just buy something that's doing you no good. You know, pay $30 a month for capsules that contain wheat flour. Would be, to me, a pretty significant harm, but the FDA doesn't step in.
So we're basically guinea pigs then.
Yeah, if you're taking a supplement, there's significant risk. And that probably goes for B12 as well. And so I do recommend people always get levels, always check, always make sure what you're doing is working. Because if you don't do levels, you could be thinking that you're fine and you're not getting the product that you think you are. And it's a reason why I'm skeptical about almost all the supplements that people take, including the ones I recommend, although my experience has been most of them.
And so we should just maybe go to our doctor once a year and get like a blood panel and see if we're low. And if we're not low, continue to do what we're doing. And if we are low, maybe have our doctor give us a prescription.
Yeah, I think a vitamin D prescription for your doctor is going to be a safer, more likely to be good way to do it. But that's kind of a hassle for some people too. And again, I don't think vitamin D and B12 are some of the worst offenders, in terms of this, because lots of people will go get blood levels tested and so they probably would actually complain in that. Whereas, if it's St. John's Wort or Saw Paul, who's going to, there's no blood level for St. John's. So, I think everybody should probably be seeing their doctor at regular intervals. Again, if you're 25 years old and you're otherwise really healthy and you've had a cholesterol tested a couple of years ago and it was really good and you're doing the same thing, do you have to go in every single year? Not if you're feeling well and you're doing well. As you get, longer in the tooth and grayer in the head, like I'm getting, probably an annual test is a good way to go. And make sure that test includes a cholesterol profile to make sure that you're getting everything correct. Now, my goal cholesterol for everybody is a total cholesterol of 150 and an LDL cholesterol of 70 or below, with triglycerides consistently under 200 or 300. Triglycerides are actually less of a risk factor than we would imagine. Most people who have high triglycerides are just, not eating great, and they can improve them a lot by their diet, but the triglycerides under 500 are not a major disease.
It's interesting you said that, because this morning in the Meal Mentor private group, people were asking about triglycerides. And what it was is one of my longtime clients, 3 years, ate a plant-based diet, no oil, no nuts, low fat. All of a sudden, out of the blue, his triglycerides were over 400. And his doctor really scared him, really made him feel like he was going to go home and have a stroke. Mm-hmm. And wanted to put him on all these medications. But then when he researched the medications, they had all kinds of risk factors that were not as scary as a stroke, but still really scary. Yeah. And he's like, oh my gosh. And anyway, long story short is we figured out it was, he was eating some sugar candy, but mm-hmm. he had recently, within the last 2 months, developed this habit of having 2 to 3 glasses of wine per week. This wasn't mm-hmm. Maybe just 1 or 2, 3 nights a week having a glass of wine with dinner. Once the wine left the diet along with the candy, the triglycerides came down. And so, of course, that was great. But the big thing is his doctor really, truly terrified him and his wife that being over 400, was like, oh, you're gonna die. And now you're saying, oh, as long as it's under 500, it's okay. Do you think that it's just overly cautious, or are really doctors just not sure of the role of triglycerides? I'm trying to, figure. It's just so uncanny that you mentioned that after this conversation today.
Well, in the group of doctors who have abandoned cholesterol for whatever reason, and I think it may be because they would not want to give up butter and bacon personally, so they try to justify what they're doing, but I couldn't try to psychologically analyze. But anyway, for whatever reason, those doctors who've accepted that do think that triglycerides are a giant risk factor. And they worry terribly about triglycerides and think that, because triglycerides do directly go up with sugar consumption. And, we talked a little bit about that earlier with fructose. Mm-hmm. But when you actually analyze this, and I've had several students where I gave the project, I said, give me a talk about, triglycerides as a risk factor for any disease. And, we really don't see significant increases like you see with cholesterol until the triglycerides are over 500. Now, the person you're discussing was appropriately skeptical of the medication. Most of the medications that we've used in the past to lower triglycerides have either been wholly or almost wholly discredited at this point. There really aren't any that I recommend to lower triglycerides, and I found much better success using flaxseed meal, which, you know, isn't necessarily something everybody should eat. But for people with high triglycerides, it seems to help drop their triglycerides very nicely. So,
yeah, and that was the thing, is like his cholesterol, everything else was great. And it just all of a sudden, you know, after 3 years of being plant-based, has happened. And but like you were saying, everything he was reading and telling me about, he couldn't really find something that said these medications actually work. And more often than not, the placebos seemed better in the studies, but they had all these side effects that were really quite frightening. And
yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes, depending on them, you would have to take an. I love to tell this story about my mom. My mom barely had high cholesterol before she was plant-based, and her doctor put her on a medicine for it. But unfortunately, that medicine made her nauseous. So then she had to take an anti-nausea pill, which then somehow required her to take an antidepressant. My mother wasn't even depressed. And so then she went plant-based, and her blood pressure was perfect. But here's the kicker. She couldn't even go off all the pills, because you can't just stop antidepressants. You have to wean off them. And I was like, this is crazy for a woman who barely had high blood pressure and high cholesterol.
The story you tell, unfortunately, is just so wildly common. You know, one medicine begets five.
Right.
The person is doing perfectly fine. They start a medicine. The medicine gives them a side effect. And rather than stop the medicine, which is any sensible approach to anybody who's having a problem after having recently started doing something. You know, it's the old doctor joke, right? Doc, it hurts when I do this. Well, don't do that.
Right.
Doc, I've been sick since I've been taking this pill. Well, stop the pill. I mean, that's such a plain and simple thing to do. But for whatever reason, there's this inertia that people get of, you have this symptom X, so we'll treat that with drug Y, which will cause side effect Z, which we can treat with drug A. And it just becomes, you know, laughable where you'll see, you know, 40 and 50 year old people coming in on 18 and 19 medicines.
Right. But that's reality. And I see it all the time when I go to, you know, like a pharmacy, like a Target, and I'm just in that part of the store buying, you know, feminine products or something. And I see these people picking up multiple bottles. And I'm like, that person's 40. They couldn't possibly have this much need for all those pills that they're carrying in this very large bag. And you can hear it, you know, rattling as they walk to check out. And I even have my own experience like that. When I was in college, I was having pain in my knee. It was hurting. And I didn't fall or play a sport. I couldn't figure out, you know, why I was having this pain. I didn't understand. And I went to my doctor and he gave me painkillers, which of course, you know, like all my friends in college were like, hey, party. But I'm like, no. I want to know why I'm having this pain so I can stop it. I don't want to just mask it. I want to fix it.
Exactly.
And it took like three doctors. And finally, it just turned out I had some stress fractures, you know, I high heels, you know, typical problem. But I was fine with enough, you know, rest and a little bit of rehab. But the first two wanted to just give me a painkiller. And I'm like, but that doesn't fix it.
Right.
But I see that all the time. Oh, you have migraines. Here's a migraine pill. Not let's figure out what's maybe triggering migraines. Oh, you have, you know, high blood pressure. Not let's change your diet. Like, here's, just take this pill.
And it's a tough situation, you know, and unfortunately, having been on all sides of it, you know, for a physician who's a primary care doctor who's trying to keep an office open, you know, what's going to take less time?
Mm-hmm.
And, what's going to move the patient through? The insurance company won't pay me more for doing lifestyle counseling. They'll pay me less, because when I write a prescription, that actually warrants a higher code of a visit. It's actually, you know, generates more revenue for the practice. So, you know, you get what you pay for. And if you pay for a lot of prescriptions, you're going to get a lot of prescriptions. And that's what the system right now rewards. And so, you know, if a doctor actually sat down and said, you know, migraines are often caused by this food, doing this elimination diet, see what happens, see if you add foods back in, they give you headaches. That takes, you know, 5-7 minutes to really explain it in an appropriate way. And you're coding the visit a lower code.
So, right. And you know, we don't want to think of doctors as being in business, but they are. I mean, it is still a business. And the same true for dentists as well. It's still a business. And so it's, it's definitely got to be, I imagine, a very tricky thing to navigate.
Well, you know, obviously most doctors, what they want is they want their patients to get better and they want to do well with their patients and they want to do the right thing. But these are very, very real incentives. And, you know, again, it's not so much that the doctor has it out for you or has any specific agenda one way or the other, the right prescriptions, but the prescriptions usually work for whatever symptom they're given for. It just may not be the ideal treatment. So from the point of view of the doctor, you know, many people who are given lifestyle advice don't change their lifestyle.
That's true.
And they prefer the pill. So the doctor, you know, may try five or six times to try to get somebody to understand it, and they keep getting rebuffed. And then, you know, eventually, again, people stop doing things that just aren't working. So sometimes you just get in the mindset of, well, prescription works for this, so take this, and if you need it more, come back and see me, and I'll write another prescription. And that's the easy thing to do. And I think, again, to some degree, that's kind of what our culture expects from both, you know, medical doctors and patients, is that the primary purpose of an office visit is prescription management.
Very true, very true. And I don't know if you knew this about me, but before I was the happy herbivore, I was a lawyer and I defended doctors. I was a med mal defense doctor, and it was
the best kind of lawyer.
I know. No, I really did feel good about being that kind of a lawyer. And I really did. Every doctor I represented, and I had all these big cases that were multi-million-dollar cases, like big, big money cases. And I really felt that my doctors absolutely did the best thing that they could have. They performed to their best. There was no error, no mistake, but just, you know, there's no guarantees. Like, right. We're humans and, you know, nothing's 100% in this life, and except death, I guess. But one thing that was really one of my last trials, one of my last big cases, was this woman who was British, and she's like, I just don't understand. In America, is everybody just wants a pill for something, but then if the pill gives you spots, they will sue you. Where, you know, where she was saying in her country, in her culture, it'd be like, oh, well, just don't take it anymore. And I thought that was just so interesting that they came out in a deposition.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm sure you've seen all sides of it. You know, in the legal system and where that interacts with medicine, it's a tough spot for people in America. Because if they get a problem that's associated with medical care, there's really no other avenue for them to get justice or to get care, even sometimes outside of the legal system. And so they're kind of blocked into that. I've heard of cases where, you know, clearly everybody understands there was a terrible mistake. Everybody wants this to be fixed, and the only avenue to fix it is a lawsuit. And I think there should be an alternate way to do that, where, you know, patients get to stay on the same side as their doctor, and everybody works together to solve a problem. But
that's definitely a lot of what I saw too.
I think in the end, it's, you know, the legal system may have some of the same problems as the medical system. You know, as a doctor, I think, you know, probably for most of my career, most of what I was doing was either just mildly beneficial or somewhat counterproductive. But, you know, if all doctors approach the things the way that I approach it, we'd probably get rid of 70-75% of the chronic disease in this country, which is the big driver of healthcare spending. Well,
right.
Insurance companies don't really want to drop the amount of payouts they have by 75%. They wouldn't be able to hold all the other stuff as profit. They'd have to drop the premiums. Hospitals don't want to empty out the hospital beds. There are whole giant corporations and hospital systems that are dependent on the hospitalization rates that exist today. And, you know, pharmaceutical industry is one of the most profitable industries in the world. They're never going to give people a push to change their lifestyle to become healthy. The only group of people who have a really vested interest and will really, really benefit from getting healthier are people themselves.
Right. You have to be your own advocate. That's what I tell my members every day. You have to be your own advocate.
So, you know, the system is a system. And when you understand that and when you know that, you may not always get the very best advice from everybody who's involved with them, but you still need to know how to manipulate it to your own benefit. I think that gives you the best of both worlds.
Absolutely. And you made a great point before, because I saw that with my cases, that there isn't really an alternative outside the lawsuits. Like, there were cases where this guy had been, the surgery had gone unwell, and he was going to need round the care medical attention for the rest of his life. And if they didn't sue, I mean, that was the only hope that they had to be able to get him to have the money to get him the care that this gentleman needed. There was no other way that he could get the care, because it wasn't even the kind of care a family member could give. Like, he needed true round the clock medical care. And like you said, there's not really another option for them except, you know, to sue. And I also saw these cases where I would just be thumbing through hospital files and see that there was, you know, John A, who was uninsured and had to get this emergency heart procedure, and it was, you know, $250,000. And then John B had insurance, got the exact same, you know, procedure, was also billed the same, but the insurance company is able to negotiate and only pay half. But the John A guy can't do that on his own, and he always gets stuck and ends up in bankruptcy.
Absolutely. I saw a statistic today, 25% of all households now have some delinquent medical bill on their credit report.
Oh my God.
It's just, you know, and the vast majority of those people have health insurance. It's just a system right now that is so focused on sickness and so focused on pills and so focused on, you know, things that are just high cost but low value items, when, you know, rice and beans are cheap.
Right.
You know, sweet potatoes are cheap, and these are the things that people really need. You know, I think Dr. McDougall has posted somewhere in one of his newsletters about how they were able to eat healthy food with, you know, great variety and good taste for $3 a day. No, this is just amazingly simple and beneficial stuff, but it's hard to get through the smokescreen. And I really do think, you know, the industries that we've talked about, I didn't even include the food industry, but all these industries sort of put up a smokescreen and they want to confuse the issue. That's all they need to do. Make it so it seems difficult or seems confusing. Kind of like the tobacco industry did back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doubt is our friend, controversy is our friend, and they want to make it seem like there's this really, you know, difficult navigation of what to eat. But, you know, 150 years ago, everybody ate out of their pantry, and it's not hard to know which foods can keep in a pantry.
Right, exactly. All winter, when nothing else was growing and there weren't planes flying mangoes in from Thailand.
So eat those.
Eat those shelf-stable foods. Yeah, it's such a great point. You know, what will last in your pantry? Dry beans, you know, uncooked rice, onions, garlic, potatoes.
Noodle.
Yeah. I did a challenge some years ago living in New York City where I lived on like $1.18 a day. I mean, it's absolutely possible. It took effort, but it was possible.
It's very possible, and in fact, you can get, you know, more calories and more nutrition for that $1.18 than you could spending $15 a day eating three fast food meals.
Oh, yeah. And we see that all the time, too, with, like, the Meal Plan members. They love to post their receipts. And a lot of them, because they have, you know, the stock pantry, they'll only spend, like, $12 or $13 a week. And it's, I mean, I think I used to spend that at McDonald's. And that's a cheap place, you know, in my pre-plant-based days. And that was for her whole week.
And that's for people who are unlucky and don't have a backyard garden.
Right, right.
We have had a backyard garden for last year, and it's just phenomenal to just be able to go out when you're preparing dinner and just chop stuff off the plant and cook it.
Oh, and it tastes so good. So good.
You can feel that.
So yummy. Well, I guess this brings us to our last question, which is, you know, do you have advice for other doctors or any kind of medical professional who wants to sort of make the plant-based prescription, who wants to convert their practice and really bring it in? Like, what has helped you? I know you have, like, materials out in the waiting room, and you, of course, talk to people, but how do you maybe prescribe that lifestyle?
Well, what we've found is that, you know, you can get so little done in the insurance system, and with, you know, just a 10 or 15 minute visit. It's just really, really hard. And when you really try to explain to somebody the benefits of a healthy diet, their skeptical guard goes up. And their response is very much like mine was. Remember, you know, when I first heard of this, I'm like, oh, there's no way that's going to actually work. And there's a whole culture that's sending that same message. So no matter how respected or how trusted somebody might be who gives somebody that message, if they don't have the time to explain it, then it just doesn't get through, because the person has so many other beliefs that conflicts with, you know, the old idea that you can't eat white rice because it's going to turn to sugar, and then that sugar will make you fat. So what we found is that, you know, the best way is to just, we sort of have two sides where people can go and be seen under the old system, and we'll, you know, do as much as we can. And we certainly give them the advice of, you know, what to do nutritionally on the side, but it's a limited amount of time. We have another side where we really focus on wellness and getting off medication. On that side, we don't take insurance. And we just, we do what's best for the patient at all times, and we don't focus on a lot of unnecessary stuff that insurance companies focus on. And that would be my advice to other physicians, is, you know, to just really make a bright line. You know, the patients who want to be in the standard of care and the standard system are welcome to get that standard care and welcome to get that standard system work. But if they really want to make a change, you know, it has to be outside that, because that system will not reward it.
Right. That was my experience too as a lawyer, and unfortunately defending doctors.
And again, you know, when you talk about total cost, the total cost of one emergency room visit is so huge compared to, you know, what people would be willing to spend, you know, for other things. You know, the food costs are cheaper when you're eating healthy.
Very true.
Supplement costs are cheaper. The over-the-counter prescription costs are cheaper. The days you get to go to work and you're not sick or, you know, laid up in the hospital are a lot more productive. And everybody, this is a, you know, thing that keeps coming back to me over and over. Anybody who makes this change, the one thing that they're universal on is their mental clarity improves.
Yes.
And thoughts become so much more clear to them, and they actually are able to consciously move through their life and make decisions more easily rather than just kind of going through the motions. I don't know if you saw Super Size Me with Morgan Spurlock.
I did. I actually saw it after I was plant-based, which I'm very thankful for, but yeah.
But you notice how he kind of even, you can see in the transition in that film, he kind of gets into a fog where the only thing about is the next McDonald's meal and the next one after that.
And he seems kind of gloomy, almost depressed-like.
Gloomy, he becomes physically sick, he can't function properly, and again, there's good physiological reasons for that. You know, high-fat foods drop blood flow by 20-30%. Your brain's a high blood need organ. You drop 20-30% off the oxygen-carrying capacity of the bloodstream, the brain probably won't like that, you know? And so people who make the change get so many huge benefits. But it does need to be done correctly, and for people who are already sick, who have, you know, high cholesterol and they're on medication, or they have high, you know, blood sugar and they're on medication, or high blood pressure and they're on medication, it needs to be done, you know, under some degree of supervision, because you can't get in trouble with those products. And so that's really what we try to offer, is a way for people to safely and effectively transition from a pill-based healthcare to a wellness.
Which is amazing. We need more doctors like you. And that's one thing my parents, you know, my father had a heart attack almost 3 years ago. And it was 3 years. Yeah, and my parents went plant-based after. And one thing that, you know, really surprised them is they were just used to paying for their medication every month. They, you know, it was just like this thing that they had always done and budgeted. They were like, wow, we've saved so much money. Like, we can kind of go on vacation a little longer. And the same thing is they noticed mental clarity. And it was something they were both concerned about, being in their late 60s. And both of them lost their parents to dementia. Both of them had a parent who had Alzheimer's. And so that was something very scary and real to them. And they noticed that their mental clarity and their ability to retain memory improved drastically, which was probably one thing from getting off the medication, but also improving their diet. And I know I saw that myself. I went plant-based in law school, and my grades were so much better. And it was easier for me to study. And I don't think that was a coincidence.
Right. And that's actually, you know, people will say, well, that's all anecdotal and that's just people's stories. But that's actually what we've seen in studies like Dean Ornish's study. People in his control groups had, you know, significantly different scores on happiness and depression and mood compared to people who are on his diet. And I think there's real truth in that. And again, nothing you know as a doctor could tell you that a 30% reduction of blood flow to the brain is a good thing.
Right. Right.
There's no way that could be good for you. Yet you see books like Grain Brain out there where, you know, Dr. Perlmutter is recommending a 75% fat diet to people as a way to prevent dementia, which is just mind blowing.
If you start me on paleo, we'll be here till tomorrow.
Well, I'm starting a blog post series on my blog on the webpage that we have, Dr. Alman, about wheat belly and grain brain. And
oh, good. I can't wait to read it.
To get through to that. And, the one thing I can say about those books is that they are, extremely seductively crafted and well brought together to create an impression that it's fundamentally different. And they're probably the most dangerous books ever written in terms of, how many people will probably die because of books. But
yeah, and that's one thing I've always toyed with. I've said I have a lot of clients and friends now too that got really bad information to the point where it did almost cost them their life. And I've wondered if, as a lawyer, could I mean, it would be so hard, but could I go after doctors for giving these bad dietary advices? Like my friend who was diabetic and about to lose their legs, and they were telling her not to eat a plant-based diet and to eat more meat, and she did and almost went blind. Or, other people, or even just these books, where they, like you said, they really craft it, but they don't necessarily have the science to support them. But people read them and then end up very ill or possibly dead.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, again, I think it's indisputable. There must have been people who read these books, followed their advice, and died. The question is establishing a clear-cut link.
Right.
And, my experience has been, these patients, what they want is they want a simple, effective, easy way to get healthy that preserves their ability to function and allows them to eat foods that make them happy and that they make them enjoy their life. And the good news is that exists.
Right.
They can do that. But it's not gotten as much of the media attention as it probably deserves from my point of view. But getting more, and cigarette smoking took a long time for people to really get to the point where they realized how bad it was. And I think we're sort of on the cusp of that realization in our society.
Yeah, and I find a lot of joy just seeing how much the movement has grown in the last 5 years or even the last year, and how many more people. I mean, just knowing the number of emails I get. I mean, I get thousands of emails a day, and I think that, I used to only get two. So I feel like that in and of itself says everything, that it is growing. People are starting it. And like you're saying, it's social proof in the beginning. People are starting to hear about it from their friends who had success, the friend that was the leader of the pack, so to speak.
Absolutely, and that I think is the thing that people can do, simply and easily without having to fight with people, is just do what you do and get the results that you're going to get. And when people see what you've gotten, my friend see I lost 45 pounds and kept it off for 3 years, they want to know more.
Yeah.
They're interested.
You look young and vibrant and healthy and you're having a great time. People want to know your secret. They'll come to you. You don't even need to open your mouth. It'll just speak for itself.
Nope, absolutely.
Well, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. I could talk to you all night because you have such great insight and so many wonderful tips. And our stories are similar, so I guess we have a lot more in common than we even got to talk about. But if you want to learn more about Dr. Alan, go to DrAlanWellness.com, and you actually spell out doctor. So DrAlanWellness.com. And like I mentioned before, he does see patients in the Las Vegas area where he lives, very jealous, but also around the world, via consultation. So check him out. And if you need a little help with your meal planning, visit GetMealPlans.com. Again, I'm Lindsay S. Nixon from Meal Mentor. This is the podcast. Thanks for listening. And thanks again to Dr. Alan for joining us.
And Lindsay, thank you so much for having me. It has been just a real pleasure. Boy, I hope we could get a chance to talk more.
Yes, I'd love to have you again sometime.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.